can take a nap with, so that we have four pillows here. and then we can start to build a new civilization. Then we need to rest now. Oh, thank you very much for inviting me, first of all, to join this conversation with you. I'm enjoying it really, really much. And there are a lot of things that I would like to ask you. But let me start with a very simple one. Why did you become interested in these Russian figures, in these forgotten sources? I think that they are kind of neglected in literature. And when people always ask me why I did my dissertation on Alexander Bogdanov, and I wanted to actually tell more stories, not just the Western one. I was investigating the history of systems thinking and cybernetic, and I thought, okay, I have to explore in the archives, I have to look at this work, Technology, the General Science of Organization, because actually it anticipated the general systems theory. So I do have an answer when someone asks me why I became crazy about these authors. What about you? Because it seems to me, it's easy to, I can imagine, it's not difficult to develop an interest in Donna Haraway or Kim Stanley Robinson, but it's not so obvious to develop an interest in this maverick authors. Why that?
Well, there's always too many answers to that question, and none of them are ever really true. I think the honest answer any author would give you is, I don't know. Yeah. But I can, retrospectively think of some threads. I'm from media studies, so we had to figure out what computation was. So computation takes you back through the history of systems theory, because those things are connected. So that's one story. I was like a teenage militant. Like, I was trained by the labor movement. My first teachers were real organic intellectuals of organized labor, and I was like fairly useless at the sort of things they had to do, like being on picket lines and so forth. So I minded the library, and I like randomly read stuff in the library. The scariest experience was getting a 2-volume Lenin and reading it through and finding pages covered over. Like, there was a page where half the page was covered over. It's like, between this being published and released, someone became a non-person. Mm. Yeah?
Yeah.
Like, this is the history of Stalinism. It's like someone, and literally every single copy of this book, someone's become a non-person. So I kind of got interested in non-people. And Bogdanov is one of the big ones, because he's a non-person before the Bolsheviks even win. So there was that. And one of the books I found in that library is Bogdanov's Political Economy was translated by the British Communist Party and used as a training manual in the 20s. Right? Because there wasn't an official Marxism-Leninism in the early 20s. So the parties did all sorts of crazy, weird stuff. And in fact, early British Marxism is all about, it's mostly all about Bukharin.
Yeah.
But there's a big chunk of Bogdanov in there as well. So I was just like, this was decades ago, but I had this like little weird sense that there's this some other little pocket over there. And then discovering that Bogdanov was thinking about, it's not quite anthropogenic climate change in Red Star because they're Martians.
Yeah.
It's Martianogenic climate change. So he has a utopia that's like a utopia you would write after Darwin, right, where you don't fix everything for all time. There's a constant struggle. So he kind of got it in 1908, yeah? And then I read in the Tectology, he sort of gets this thing about the atmospheric physics of carbon.
Yeah.
Like, he never quite connects these things together, but he sort of got it. Like, he got biosphere. So I thought, I'm doing research on Marxists because those are my people. Like, still, yeah, I feel a certain loyalty to the militants who trained me. That's where I got Bogdanov.
It wasn't the general science of organization, the Tectology, that you read first. It was the political...
It was the political economy, which is not quite as orthodox as... Like, it's interestingly weird, too, but that's another story.
I was impressed by the main statement of your book. Namely that we need new narratives and new theories because, we are in presence of new facts. So this means that current narratives are not able, actually, to solve the challenges that the Anthropocene poses us. I was thinking, while I was thinking about that, it came to... in into my mind that even Emmanuel Wallerstein, for instance, took it really right when he said that even anti-systemic movements and popular resistance actually do not provide alternative to the system, but they actually serve to reinforce the capitalist system. And so I thought maybe this is the case with Platonov and Bogdanov, but as you said in the book, they are facing the tragedy of their times, and they're kind of proposing new narratives, new models. We see the organization of knowledge put forward in technology to solve the situation of their time. But actually, they didn't make it. They didn't survive throughout the course of the history. So how can we expect not to fail by recovering and unveiling these sources and use them to overcome the Anthropocene?
I mean, I think if you start with this premise that, and to you, the category civilization is a somewhat loaded one, and which one can talk about that, but the civilization we're in, like, its days are numbered and we know it, right? Everyone knows it. There's just a kind of a public disavowal of this fact. Like, this one's not gonna work out.
Yeah.
It needs modification at the very least. So it seems to me, rather than read the people who celebrated how awesome it was, like, that's not very helpful. Let's read people who tried another civilization and failed at it and knew it. Like, that seems to be, like, those are our people. That's who we need to know. Bogdanov is already a critic of, sotto voce, of the Soviet Union in 1917, right? Like, the militarizing of the party in the Civil War, Bogdanov thinks is the opposite of what organization should be about. And he's a kind of loyal opposition figure. But Platonov is just there. Like, he's there on the ground. Like, he lived through the Civil War. He lived through NEP. Like, he saw what forced collectivization was like. And it kind of destroys his mind, and he reorganizes language and writes about it. And I just think those Platonov anti-novels are masterpieces of the 20th century that everyone should know about. Yeah? They really should be part of world literature.
Yeah.
But I think I'm not a Russian scholar, I'm not even a literature person, but the thing I can read in it that I think even his translators sometimes miss is he was a Marxist, like he really was, like he's a believer. Like, I recognize my people when I see them, right? He's like, oh, comrade, I see what you're doing here. Like, and he's surrounded by this noise of Marxological language that's on the radio, for example, and in the newspapers, and he sort of, it's a detournement of that, and he kind of explains the disaster in its own language as a peasant would or as a semi-educated worker would. Like, it's just, like, that's the voice you need to hear, yeah? So it's not, you can read Trotsky saying from on high in the 20s about what may or may not be going on, but here's your man on the ground saying, here's what we heard, here's what we did, and here is how hard it is. Like the fancy dreams of the gleaming superstructures, underneath that is someone with their feet in the shit trying to make it work, and he's that person. So, I think moments of historical change require rethinking what the archive is that matters.
Yeah.
It's not just reinterpreting the people we think are there forever. We need new pasts.
And maybe we need to look at the way losers thought about history. Yeah. We need new histories. I mean, new stories about the history. Because I was thinking of what Marx wrote about the fact that great personages, great figures happen in the history twice. The first time, as a tragedy, and the second time as a farce. Mm-hmm. And here we are not, of course, dealing with great figures. We are dealing with known people.
I think it's got to be a three-part joke now. It's like first time is tragedy, second time is farce, third time is just memes. Like, the third one's even worse. The second one at least seemed to make sense. Yeah.
So we need, obviously,
new ancestors. It's a paradoxical word, right? But we need new ancestors because, the ancestors we've been using are late Holocene thinkers.
Yeah.
They're thinkers who, for example, thought you could bracket off the social from the natural and that wouldn't be a problem because there's some stable relationship between them.
Yeah.
Like, none of that's any help. Like, the foundation of social science is that in a lot of ways, and it's no longer any help.
So I really think it makes sense to give space and bring to light forgotten sources and forgotten authors. We are actually pursuing a project, a research project at our institute about that, about enriching our narratives of the Anthropocene and for the Anthropocene by looking at the work of people who are at fringe of current scientific literature. So that's why I was insisting on this point. So, Ken, when we talk about this gestaltic shock, this paradigm shift that we need to get out of this terrible situation, do you think this can happen through a kind of reshaping our knowledge in a gradual way, progressively, and so making use of existing knowledge, which actually brought to the point we are and actually allowed us to identify the Anthropocene? Or you think following Bogdanov and Russian Bolshevist revolutionaries, we really need to cut with all existing knowledges to produce, a revolutionary momentum in always to get out of this period and go ahead and go forward?
I don't know. no one does, because, right? Yeah. It's a moment that's historically unprecedented, but here's the other shoe dropping, right? It's geologically unprecedented. What does it mean to be in a geologically unprecedented moment? We don't really have the intellectual tools to deal with that. So I think it would be kind of false advice to say, yes, we should follow this strategy. It's I have no idea. Let's try all of it. You have to try everything. Yeah.
No, because I was thinking of evolution, how the evolution works and how biological species evolve. Yeah. Stephen Jay Gould told us that the evolution occurs, through punctuated equilibrium. Mm. So why this has to be different with society? We really need to get rid of old infrastructures, of old institutions, to update our culture. Even Antonio Gramsci, you mentioned some positions of some Western Marxists. Even Antonio Gramsci believed that a revolutionary change would occur with a cultural change that has to pass through a cultural change. And I'm really insisting on that because I really think we need to get over somehow. Mm-hmm. Well, this is very difficult.
Yeah, and we cannot compare. I've sort of gone back to my more vulgar Marxist roots.
Yeah.
And and the dominant, sort of critique of vulgar Marxism is it's all about prioritizing the relations of production. I actually want to be even more vulgar than that and prioritize the forces of production and sort of think through how transformations in the forces of production changed not only forms of economic organization, but cultural habits and cultural metaphors in ways we haven't really quite processed. So this is just not the capitalism of the 1850s.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I haven't seen a steam engine in the last decade run anything. Yeah, they're just not there. It's something else. And it's not just that the commodity form got extended to incorporate more things and to include information. It's that those things have changed the commodity form as well. So I think one kind of needs a fresh language to think through whatever this mode of production actually even is. But I would do it in sort of a vulgar way of starting with, force of production are different. And they're the things one tends to bracket off and not sort of pay attention to. So I'd want to press on that a little more rather than I'm a recovering Gramscian. I'm from the 80s, man. In the Anglophone world, we Gramscied hard at that time. So I've sort of moved back away from that because we thought we could advance in the cultural sphere independently of what happened below in the classic metaphor. And I'm a little more skeptical about that. But so as to not contradict the earlier answer, let's do everything at once. So by all means, let's sort of press on with the construction of new forms of life, some of which will prioritize the formation of a philosophy. Is there an appropriate philosophy for the times? Yeah. Or philosophies plural. That's an important thing to be working on. And it might be more important to conduct the parallel experiments than to always be arguing with each other, And it's thank God we didn't start this with let's not call it the Anthropocene, let's call it something else.
The Capitalocene or Chalupa.
I don't care. Call it whatever you like, right? Just acknowledge something's happening.
Yeah.
It's just not interesting. It really is the first pass thing we have to get beyond.
Absolutely. As far as we know it, we realize that the Anthropocene is something culturally rooted, not just, we can, we have to think about it in cultural terms, using the most diverse forms of knowledge. And so I don't think that the idea that the Anthropocene is arising out of the capitalism would help us, I mean, fighting capitalism. We need something more.
They're both equally useful. Like the capitalocene people are like onto something, and it works and it explains certain things, but it has certain limits because you reduce yourself to thinking about capitalism. And yes, there is a bit of a problem with making Anthropos the central figure, but it's actually not quite what you think it is when you make that critique. And it's a really useful word to have in your lexicon if you want to talk to earth scientists, because that's how they're talking about it. So it's like, oh, okay, I'll speak the language you guys are using. They're not all agreed on it, obviously, but that's how you speak there. And then I have people who want to talk about the capital scene. And then there's the Thousand Names of Gaia people over there, slightly more romantic. All right, whatever works for you. And it's like parts of the
puzzle. It's so complex, I mean, as a concept.
Yeah, and but let's not try and have intellectual arguments about which is better. Let's think about it, you know, like sociologically. How do you process this historical moment in a different language, in different communities, and keep them in dialogue? Like, that's the politics of knowledge now.
Oh, I think that a central category in your book and in your work actually is the notion of labor. Mm-hmm. Labor is really, I mean, I would like you to a little bit expand on that. I mean, I was thinking that all problems arising out of the Anthropocene are related somehow in the first place with labor. I'm thinking of trade, market, development issues, sustainability, or global inequalities between global South and global North, in the West, during Cold War, and blah, blah, blah. And I was thinking that there is an Ukrainian physician, Sergei Podolinsky, who tried to update the theory of Marx, the theory of labor of Marx, with an account on thermodynamics, entropy. He believes that all the energy that we receive from the sun has to be maximized on Earth to produce new labor in order not to dissipate this energy. So labor seems to be about labor again. This is really... Well, I wanted to ask you, having in mind that Bogdanov thinks that labor is a means through which organize nature and to which organize the world, how can we reshape the relationship between men and humanity and nature through organization and labor, having in mind an extended framework, an extended definition of labor that, as you explained very well in your book, now includes digital labels, for instance, which is kind of separating us from nature. I mean, this is a barrier in a way. Because,
all right, there's a few things there.
Yeah.
There may be a little inconsistency in how Marx thinks about labor, and there's a kind of Hegelian view of labor as spirit infusing itself in the world. But I think Marx also starts to think labor through thermodynamics, and his relation to Hegel is much more studied than his relation to the scientific materialism of the post-1948 moment. And that's really kind of more interesting. Like, Marx starts to think, oh, labor is part of a thermodynamic model of how the world works. Now, he's a little inconsistent about this, and he still wants to make human labor a slightly separate thing from other kinds of energy. It has a certain separate quality. In some ways, that's kind of not going to work. It is part of the same, if you're a consistent monist, you know, labor's another kind of energy. There's lots of kinds of energy. They're all the same thing. You'd want to sort of push back on that. However, and this, I think, is Bogdanov's whole relationship to Marx, is to say the central thing in Marx is not dialectical materialism or anything like that. It's the labor point of view. Marx thinks from the labor point of view. Bogdanov goes as far as to say the working class wrote Das Kapital. Marx was the stenographer. Yeah, like this the book is the product of a movement. So it's a version of a standpoint theory, in a sense. So, and to me, that's one element not to lose sight of. From what point of view are you trying to view the world? You're not really viewing it from a universal, placeless, you know, objective point. You know, let's kind of adhere to a point of view here. So in that sense, I stick with Marx and Bogdanov. You know, I work for a living. I always have. I always will. I'm one of those who work. I believe in the fraternity or sorority of all of those who work. A lot of those who work aren't human anymore. Like, that has to be dealt with. That which labors includes other species, it includes technologies. Someone has to think labor in a much broader way. But keeping the human point of view in the center of it, but without thinking it special anymore. One has to sort of, it is my point of view because that's who I am, but it's not necessarily a special kind of labor. Mm-hmm. And yet, it turns out that that view of planet-wide energy system, that's now like a legitimate science. Like Vaclav Smil will give you an estimate for how much of photosynthesis on the planet is for human use, 20%, right? So it's like, this is legitimate science. Now, they're estimates, and he gives you all of the reasons they're, you know, our estimates of this are shaky. And that should give us pause, right? That we actually can't quantify human use of energy on the planet well is already a problem, but that seems to me to be a useful point of view to further develop. And that it partly has Marxist roots as a thing sort of not to lose sight of, even though Smil would not identify with that point of view at all. So it's to sort of keep two things in mind. One, that, you know, labor's in some ways maybe not special. It's part of a global energy system. Yeah. On the other hand, it's what I am. It's my point of view. So it's keeping those two ideas together.
But what I found very interesting is your, the way you expanded the notion of labor to include scientific labor, academic labor, artistic labor, and precarious labor, and even non-labor. I mean, this is very interesting to me, because when I think of Bogdanov's and the way he conceives labor, there is always an activity, an active behavior that aims at grasping a fact of nature. But where we are in presence of digital labor, for instance, and we lose contact with nature, how can can think about labor, to organize nature or new forms of organizing nature without active labor?
One can see how something like what Haraway calls like a code fetishism.
Yeah.
When your relation to nature is kind of mediated by a whole apparatus of extracting numerical values from it, and you're working, in fact, only on the numerical values and not even seeing the organisms that it comes from, right? Because someone else does that. That's just grunt work for grad students or whatever. Not even, so you can sort of fetishize this and think code is everything, which is a little bit where we are now, like algorithms run the world.
Yeah.
And it's partly true. The thing about any fetish is it's always partly true, right? Algorithms are powerful things in the world. But they only run if you've got a computer under them and a huge energy source that runs the computer, right? So it's to get out of the fetishistic view of it and to see all of those things as connected to labor. Maybe labor is too big a category also. The fact that commodification now works on non-labor in a new way, like it always did. So work women did in the home in your classic nuclearized, you know, sort of developed world, that's non-labor. That's work, right? It's effort, but it's not labor in the sense of belonging directly to the commodified system. But that category is like vastly expanded. So basically, every time you open your laptop to entertain yourself, you're performing free labor for someone else, right? For Google or for Apple or whoever. I met a grad student once who was working on something else, but he talked about doing work on streaming. Like we think of, I don't know if you say this in German or something like it, but streaming is like, I'm just streaming a TV show. Right? I'm streaming it to me. It's like, no, you're streaming your data to them. Yeah, you got to think a stream that works both ways at the same time. Where the one that matters is it's streaming away from you.
Yeah? Like Bogdanov's transfusion, blood transfusion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, in terms of it was not science what he did, right? This has to be said at the outset. But the metaphors he's playing with, he was sort of onto something about sharing and reciprocity in an interesting, weird way. So labor, but to think it in a much more expanded way, and then maybe to look at the internal differences within it.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me go then to the last questions of Ken. I had like other 3 pages. I told you at the beginning that I wanted to ask you so many things.
I was so scared because she really knows this stuff. Like she's a real student of it. I just wrote a book about it because I thought it was interesting, you know.
Okay, this is I mean, it's the most interesting one. No, well, how would you imagine a technology in the 21st century? How do you imagine, would you imagine the product cult of the 21st century? And if you can share with us any experiences, any, I mean, practical experiences you have been part of, you have participated in, that resemble some kind of this association nowadays, of course. Because I have the impression that these attempts, these experiments, even the Capri School, this laboratory of knowledge, were very local. And I don't think, very local and run by an elite, very aristocratic, I would say, even though they, I mean, we're dealing with Marxists, heretic Marxists. How would you imagine such an association today working on a global scale? Because, I mean, we have so many problems in this world. This world is split. We have fights among states ongoing, I mean, every single day. We have problems. We have even Trump, who denies the climate change, although his chief strategy, Chief Bannon, helped to build the biosphere, too. So this is... Well, really, really odd.
Another story. Yeah.
Oh my God! And if you think that maybe the hyperreal world on the web could help us in managing something like that on a global scale, because I'm actually a little bit disillusioned by that. I think that the web has failed in many points. I was thinking of what Dan Schiller called digital capitalism, who causes even more inequalities. I mean, in the social context. Or even the way we produce our work in the academic world, even the way we use to organize knowledge through social media, such as, for instance, Academia Edu or ResearchGate. I was reading what Alessandro Del Fante says about this. They are financial market of ideas. So, I mean, even the web needs new forms of organization. What's your opinion about that? I'm very curious.
Yeah, you know, I had a second life as a militant, which was in the sort of avant-garde around internet in the 80s and the 90s. And I think we won the battle and then lost the war. Everything we tried to build, the Transmediale, which is held here every other year as part of, you know, that whole legacy, everything we tried to build got co-opted and commodified. So we tried. We fought the good fight. But, you know, look, any margin of autonomy or liberty that individual users still have has got to do with those social movements resisting things. So, you know, like, technologies don't just build themselves automatically. They're fields of struggle between different forces. All right, and there's a few pieces to this. And one would be, I don't want to call it capitalism with a modifier. So my provocation to you is this. What if this is not capitalism anymore, but something worse? Right? What if this is a new mode of production? What would be the conditions of possibility for making that case? Like, that seems to me to be a debate that really needs to happen. And I'm always told repeatedly when I do this why it must still be capitalism. Because apparently capitalism is eternal. Right? It's an essence that has only appearances that change. And those are signaled by sticking a new modifier on it. Some of which, let's face it, actually make no sense. How can you call it neoliberal capitalism? Even your modifier's got a modifier. Like, I'm sorry, I deal with language. When you start abusing language like this, then clearly there's no concept there, the root of it. Yeah. It doesn't work. So, and since we're short on time, I'm going to, like, really shorthand this one. There's already been two modes of production based on commodification. The first was the landlord system. In Germany, it was the Junker system. Mm. Capitalist class fought them and was opposed to them and had to abolish them, right? Same thing in England, only it happened earlier. Ricardo, one of Marx's sources, it's about the struggle between capital and not labour, but landlords. You can have multiple ruling classes based on multiple forms of commodified mode of production at the same time. So what if there was landlordism, capitalism? There's various radically non-standard versions of both of those. If you start looking in the rest of the world, right, that's the provincial European version, that there was two, there's already multiple. What if there's a new one? What if there's something after capitalism that's worse, and it's based on the commodification of information, which changes what the commodity form is and how surplus is extracted and how power is maintained? So in other words, we confront something for which we don't yet have a language. We keep using this old language and sticking modifiers on the front of it as if it's just a new appearance of the old thing. What if it's not? Marx didn't do that. Marx came up with a new language to describe a new phenomena in the world. That's our task now. Yeah? Yeah. So that's the first thing. It ain't capitalism. It's worse. So there are a lot of it's not capitalism, it's better stories, like the post-industrial and the third way. I'm not doing that. So it's worse. It's not better. But it's not quite capitalism. So we need a new language. It works in a different way. How surplus is extracted is different. So the sites of struggle are different. The forms of struggle are different. The language of struggle will be different, right? So I refuse to work on May Day and go join the general strike in New York City with 200 other people, because most people don't know what that means anymore. It's a language from another era that's very dear to me, but it's not like I'm going to make the world think like we're all 19th century labor movement people. It needs a new language, even if that's one of them. Like, I don't want to refuse it or criticize that those are my people. So what would new forms of organization now be that prolet cult is a precursor story, but we wouldn't do it like that. Bogdanov's trying to organize a lot of workers who probably couldn't read or did not read at a very sophisticated level and read different languages. Russia's an empire. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands of people joined prolet cult. It was a mass movement.
Yeah.
Maybe they did it because you got food and there was heat. We don't know. Like, there's complicated versions of the history.
It arrived even in Latin America.
Yeah.
In a drama.
And it turns out, actually, prolet cult was very influential around the place. Maybe Gramsci got things from it.
Yes, of course.
Early English Marxists were very influenced by it. So let's dig out that neglected strand. It wouldn't quite be the same thing, but wherever you see people trying to organize knowledge and practice around an agenda that's not driven by the academy itself, but is driven by the real world, it's not driven by the market either, so we're not doing TED Talks, and we're not doing, I have a slightly different interpretation of Walter Benjamin, right? We're doing, it's the frickin' Anthropocene. Let's organize knowledge. Like, that's where we're starting. So Anthropocene here at House of World Culture and its collaborators, that to me is a wonderful example. Yeah? What Haraway and her colleagues did with the history of consciousness going back to the 70s. Like, that's a model. So let's start looking for those other models.
And which will be the role of intellectuals?
I think I'm getting the wind-up here.
Okay, maybe next.
Role intellectuals, that's the new book, that's General Intellects. But yeah, well, we'll come back and talk about that another time. I want to give the audience a shot at anyone have thoughts or questions out there. Yes, I have a person waving over here.
Diana here, haunting you from
the past. Hey, Diana, how are you?
Yeah. Thanks so much. I need the both of you to sort of address a couple of very urgent problems that I don't know if they're from the past or the future. So let's go with, let's say, the novel, What Is to Be Done, not the Lenin's quite point, the novel. How that maybe has it influence on the free, on the Gurian Republic.
Sorry, on?
On the Gurian Republic, and how that Gurian Republic actually then inspires Bogdanov's writing of Red Star, because I think there's no way to disassociate them. Mm. How those things then influence the socialist project of cybernetics with the CyberSyn project, and for example, how those, like the political crisis in the Soviet Union also basically is the ground of soil science or what has become agronomy, and how that like gets manifested in different African liberation struggles. So that, because those are things where there's very direct relationships and impacts and so on. And I think, yeah, because that's like time traveling stuff. So could you guys like connect some dots?
Yeah, there's, and it's like, I don't want to, you know, say, no, these are the things that matter in this story, not these other things. There's always ways you can unpack the story differently. So I read a paper of Julia's that does Avenarius and Bogdanov, and I was thinking, oh, this actually makes more sense. I did it with Mark because I want to tell a California story, and Faye Rabin is a great interpreter of Mark. So I didn't do Avenarius, but it's like, oh, your version makes more sense. I kind of like.
No, well, it was. Yeah. I mean, Bogdanov was inspired by both of them.
By both, yeah, by both. That's the thing.
I made an
aesthetic choice, is what I'm saying. It's like, oh, I'm going to tell it this way because I'm creating a book that's like a novel. It's got an arc and it's got a pattern. But you're right. Chernyshevsky's an influence on everybody. It's not a book I personally like all that much. It seems a little ascetic and austere for me, so I like didn't, you know, and it's a huge influence on that whole generation of Russian revolutionaries, you know, like it's like really there in the background.
what I mean specifically, and both in Red Star and What Is to Be Done, they actually do have kind of like hand guides. They have like how to's. They have entire sections that are basically how to build a revolutionary state. And so that's sort of what I mean, like, because those things kind of, it's like if they would be blogs now, I guess.
Yeah, and it has to be said, the literary merit of Bogdanov's novels is questionable, but they're written for a popular audience. Like, they're popular entertainment, they're widely read. The prequel to Red Star is probably even more important, because it is. It's how to have the revolution, and it's actually kind of interestingly prescient in lots of ways. So yeah, they really still repay reading for lots of different reasons. The one thing about the engineer many is questions of class alliance. So it's like an engineer worker alliance. I think that's so contemporary. Yeah, I had lots of debates about the science march, where people are like, no, I'm not marching for science. Haven't we been against science for the past? We've been critiquing science for 30 years. And it's like, we've been critiquing science within the space of knowledge, and we should continue to do so. In the larger political space, when scientists are under attack, so are we. So can we think tactically about our relation? Like, so it seems to me, and sometimes I'm thinking, you should read this book by Bogdanov from 1911 or whatever, you know, about alliances with other classes who have different languages. So yeah, there's other histories you could tell about where Bogdanov comes from. There are particular things I wanted to draw out, just to, part of its aesthetic choices. The What Is to Be Done really is not my thing, because it's just so kind of aesthetic. And I'm from that version where, you know, I don't want your revolution if I can't take ecstasy. Like, that was how we rolled in the 80s, right? So, like, Chernyshevsky's just not, like, that whole, like, aesthetic. And it's where Lenin gets that whole aesthetic sort of thing from. Not my style, you know, like what we would have called the sad militants from Deleuze and Guattari. Nah, can't go there. But if that's your thing, and I'm no judgments, right, then by all means read that literature and follow that line. The other pieces are agronomy, and I'm interested in Marx's relation to von Liebig, because that's where, like, the Marxist term for Anthropocene is metabolic rift, right? Marx has already almost got it. So that strikes me as interesting, to start thinking, before we even get to industrial capitalism, we've really got to think the landlord system and the commodification of agriculture. Like, Marx kind of skips over that a little bit. Like, he knows he has to fill it in, never gets around to it. It's where also Ricardo, like, as I mentioned, worth reading, because that's the class struggle, is between different ruling classes. We need to know how to think that. And I really, really wanted to do something about Vavilov, but he didn't end up in the book, because Vavilov is the great tragic story. And he was a bioprospector, among other things, possibly biopirate, you know, traveling the world looking for seed stocks. Like, really incredible work of like, that he knew would take generations, right? To improve Soviet agriculture would take generations, because the experiments on different seed varieties would take that long. And, you know, like, it's too big a story to shorthand, but, like, Stalin is like, no, you know. And this poor fellow suffers in jail and dies there, and his Marxist scientific colleagues around the world really did not do enough for the Vavilov case. This is a really key part of the story, and I would have loved to have written something about it. There was a great book, I can't remember the title, that someone follows in the footsteps of Vavilov around the world to see what seed varieties people are using, and it's already about how people are moving which varieties work where across different biomes because of climate change. It's got a more romantic, like, hippie version of seed stocks and so forth, which maybe is appropriate to go to, but that's a whole huge question that we didn't get into.
And you could be very much interested in the work of Sergei Podolinsky that we just mentioned, about energy distribution and the Earth seen as a complex system that actually reacts as a kind of a cybernetic interpretation of the Earth. It was also related to Marx's theory of labor. He actually corresponded with Marx, and Marx replied to him. We found this document in an archive in Moscow, and Marx said, yeah, of course, I should see, I actually should revise my theory of labor according with what you are saying. I mean, he was like 20 years old physician from Ukraine, and that is such an honor.
microphone is moving.
Brilliant lecture. It's triggering many thoughts. And I wanted to, maybe one of the really positive things that we're talking about here is the collaborative work. And so I want to elaborate on something about that. We have this alt-right version of denying the climate science and climate disruption. And I kind of see, I sort of got some insight in how the left is also sort of in denial of the techno-fascism around us. And I'm very concerned about how we are not looking at how to collaborate with a non-anthropocentric nature. So last month there was a conference of the Zapatistas and talking about how to use science for defending their position on the earth and indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And so kind of to try to get you to look at it from that framework, is there a way that we can collaboratively work with a very intelligent kind of ecosystem around us rather than thinking that we're going to completely let this one just, you know, burn and we're working on the, you know, a collapsed environmental situation, but rather really trying to work like the indigenous in a way that we can collaboratively work to repair the damage that corporate capitalism has done on our the environment that we need to live on and with. So I see a little bit in your pushing the second nature aspects and the science to utilize it for us, the Anthropocene. But there's something here about the non-anthropocentric that we need to work with, I think, and I wonder if you could reflect on that.
Yeah, I have a longstanding interest in the question of the indigenous because I'm Australian, and the, you know, one of the central questions in Australian cultural studies was the question of the indigenous. And the work of Eric Michaels was very influential on me. He actually took systems theory and information theory and applied it to anthropology in the 80s. It was kind of like mind-blowing stuff. So I'm interested in that, and there's like a double sense in which the indigenous comes back into play, and one has to do with the experience of the loss of a world. Which for many indigenous people is how they would report what has happened. That, you know, what are you talking about? Your world is ending. You already ended ours. You know, it's a paraphrase, right? So the emotional work of surviving the end of a world is something that one actually gets in indigenous art, indigenous narrative, indigenous philosophy. That's of interest. But the other piece of it is, well, actually, you know, often those were land use practices that they worked often for very small populations, but worked over extremely long time periods. In Australia, that's very true. And it may be why some anthropologists say the oldest continually worshipped deity in the world is actually the river serpent, which is a kind of connecting story that's used up and down the centre of Australia. And there's, you know, sort of rock carving evidence going back thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years for river serpent. So it's like, oh, well, you guys survived not anything as dramatic as the end of the Holocene, but some pretty extraordinary variations in world throughout that period, and that's worth paying attention to. I think the person who's organised that is Eduardo Viveiros de Castro. Apologies to Portuguese speakers that I can't pronounce that better, who did a event called The Thousand Names of Gaia, which is sort of very much about thinking not just multicultural but multi-natures. How is it that if we sort of pluralize what worldviews are, then the categories I'm using here can be provincialized. We wouldn't just think about, I was trying to have a very open-ended concept of nature as that which labor encounters, but this is still very much a modern and possibly Western one. I don't know its boundaries, but I want to acknowledge that I'm offering a bounded concept, not a universal one. So I think that dialogue with Indigenous experience is really, really important. It's just really difficult to have because you're often talking about the least well-resourced people in terms of being able to do that, and is it necessarily other people's priority to be you know, talking to a bunch of white people about their problems. So yes, I want to highlight the centrality of the Indigenous question, two reasons why it matters, someone who I think is doing much better work on that than me, who's an actual ethnographer. Then the other piece was to do with collaboration is, like, for Bogdanov, there's always, like, hybrids of how social labour, broadly speaking, is organised. It's always partly organised around authority. It's partly organised around exchange. But the one that gets, you know, forgotten about is, you know, collaboration and cooperation. So are there ways of rethinking the classic stories that sort of highlights that element, yeah, brings that to the fore? And to extend it beyond Bogdanov a little bit, but I think it's a spirit he'd recognise, where collaboration can include the non-human. Yeah, so I think there's a capaciousness in the concept to be sort of extended into those directions. And one can connect it up to forms of labour today. I mean, a lot of digital work is, like, ridiculously collaborative. It just all passes through GitHub, you know? Like GitHub is hacker-class socialism. It's just, A, it's privately owned, and B, no one would think of it in that language. You don't write this stuff, you assemble it, yeah? Like, your genius or your skill is being able to put the pieces together. Yeah? So there are ways, even, I think, very contemporary forms of labour, if that's what it still is, have forms of cooperation one can talk with and to. You know, it's a question of threading them together.
So I had a different kind of question about collaborative labour and of organising work differently, which is, you talked about perhaps having to change a lot of the structures and ideas that we have used in the past to think about changing the world because of the Anthropocene. I wondered, would that include changing the idea of disciplines or getting rid of the idea of disciplines? Is that a pre-Anthropocene concept that's doing more harm than good?
Yeah, I don't know. It might be timely to do a little investigation in the history of how disciplines were formed and what objective was supposed to organise them, and to what extent they fall victim to a kind of formalisation where it becomes, like, gamified. Yeah, it becomes a game space. The objective is to get good at the game of getting certain papers in certain journals and so on, where it sort of doesn't actually then connect to anything very much. And where no one discipline is more guilty of that than others. Although, you know, because I sit on the college-wide tenure committee, it's always like, oh my God, you guys are idiots. You just, like, you know, you played the game well and that's tenure. But then it's like, oh, I think my guys do that too, you know. So it's sort of like not be, one has to be holistic in approaching that. Knowledge needs organising, and it really clearly needs forms of error correction. So the thing to avoid is that, you know, we'll have no disciplines, anything goes. There's you know, constrained situations within which Feyerabend's anarchy of knowledge works. Like, there's a constraint within which that then becomes something that works. And we sort of lose sight of that part of it a little bit. And that's so important in a world that's full of, like, climate deniers and people still being paid to say that smoking's not bad for you. People who think vaccination is a bad thing because they read about it on the internet. So, you know, to not have the critique of the limits of science, like, science, any form of knowledge ought to understand it's limited, it needs a certain modesty, but to not sort of flip from that to, all right, then I'll just believe any old random thing anywhere. Like, the whole point of enlightenment in that sense was, you know, error correction, noise reduction. So what are those processes? And they're not all modern. It connects back to the indigenous story. There are anthropologists who think that Australian Indigenous people have successfully told stories that are more or less true over thousands of years through oral communication, but it's got to do with a structure of error correction. In some Western Desert societies, they're divided in half, and where if you're in charge of a story for one half of it, the person who corresponds to you from the other half validates whether you got it right or not. So you're not the authority, right? The authority is shared between someone who has the power to say, you got this bit wrong. This is not what this is or means. So we have reports of things that happened when the landscape was different, and scientific geological knowledge can confirm that where they're saying, you know, there was water hundreds of miles inland, there really was. So it's like, it's not only, you know, the Enlightenment that knows how to do error correction and noise reduction. There are other forms of knowledge that do it. But separating those two thoughts is really hard. Like, we like to think we've got a monopoly on correct knowledge, yeah? But maybe we don't. Like, maybe it becomes too highly formalized. Maybe it got attacked by certain kinds of parasitism, like these sort of pseudo-foundations in the United States that are there to provide knowledge about anything that rich people think would be handy to be true. So the struggle around the organization of knowledge turns out, I think, to be really central to whatever the Anthropocene is about.
Hello, hi.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk. I had a question about what you said in response to the question before last about defining nature as that which labor encounters, because I was curious about that throughout your whole talk. If you could explain that a bit more, because what is the interest in delineating the territory of nature as such and pitting it against nature or labor, or separating it from labor, and how can that hold without feeding into the same invincible process of commodifying everything? Because it seems to me that this whole process of commodification depends on that idea somehow. I don't know. So I'm wondering what you think about this.
Yeah, I'm resistant to the thought that the problem with the West is that it had an idea of what nature is, and everything comes from the problem with an idea. Because the West always had several different competing and incompatible ideas about what nature is. In German, I don't know. In English, Raymond Williams says nature is one of the two or three most complicated words in the language, because it means both that which is not human, but it also means something that includes the human. So one really has to think the poetics of something that's several different things at once. And if one wants to say that, for example, the problem with the West is Descartes, then what about Spinoza, for whom nature is kind of like the opposite to what it is in Descartes, you know? So there's like a field within which terms operate, partly logically, but partly through the non-logic but structure of language itself. So one would have to kind of think it through that. So I wanted a kind of restricted concept of nature. Part of, in the background of this is I've kind of went the other way to Timothy Morton. Like, Tim's thought is ecology without nature. I think ecology is more problematic, so I want to do nature without ecology, because I think there's an assumption built into ecology about homeostasis, and our problem is a lack of it. So, all right, how do we think nature where one doesn't try to attribute a quality to it in advance? Because our habit is to overcode it with whatever we think is natural about social organization. So to pre-capitalists, in the pre-capitalist West, nature is often surprisingly feudal in its organization. And later it becomes about exchange. And in the Greeks it was always both, right? Because the Greeks were always a trading culture. And nature seems quite naturally to include the category of slavery, because many Western societies were slave-owning and think it's cool to think that is a thing that's in the world. So it's tricky. So hence the formal definition. Now, all right, given, doing this puts a lot of weight on the category of labor, and in the second half of the book I complicate that. But in the first half, all right, labor. Nature is what labor encounters. So it doesn't say what it is that labor encounters. It just says it encounters it. And if there's another key word in Bogdanov, it's resistant. Yeah? So labor encounters nature, but nature pushes back. And that's actually where Platonov's interesting, because in Platonov, it really pushes back. It pushes back to the point of disorganizing you. But this is the first thought. So the second thought is, all right, so if nature is what labor encounters, what labor will think nature is determined by the form of labor itself. So the form of the organization of labor then starts to give you an image or a model of what you think nature is. That's going to be, and this is the third thought, it's going to be partly true because it works, but it's going to be partly not true because it's a metaphor that you've imported from a labor process. So that's the three bits of it. To think that nature is hierarchically organized, it's partly true. But it's partly you came out of a hierarchically organized society. That's what you think it is. Like Shakespeare's full of this stuff, yeah? You think that nature is a form of competitive exchange. The Greeks were already thinking that because that's the kind of society they lived in. But it's a model that Darwin imports willy-nilly, yeah? It's like actually most of Darwin's work doesn't actually point to nature being a market. It's kind of much more interesting and complicated than that. But you can see how if you live in at the peak of a, you know, English imperial market society, it's going to kind of creep in there, yeah? From Spencer. So, yeah, one wants to be a little careful. All of these metaphors partly work. They partly explain things. They're not wrong, but they're limiting. So to think nature is this kind of like placeholder concept that's formal, like it's a concept I'm trying to get to work in a formal structure. So it at least avoids the problems I've outlined in those three parts. But as I think I've gestured elsewhere, it's still got some other issues. This is, you know, I'm from a Western settler society that, you know, predisposes me to think nature in a certain way. I come from a weird peripheral one, so I certainly do not think nature is stable and homeostatic because in Australia, nature just isn't. So it's like, what ecology? There's no freaking ecology, yeah? It's like, you know, we have two relations to nature where I come from. It's either flood or drought. Like, there's no mean. There's no average in between. And those are randomly distributed, yeah? And it's not the only part of the world that thinks about nature that way, yeah? So to have, like, a plural dialogue about this word that's extremely common in European languages and with its cognates in others, but where we think about it formally and not try to say too much about it. And it's where Anthropocene is a really useful circuit breaker because you start to call it something else. And you start to think it in terms of a pivot or change in geological time. That then gives you extra leverage on all of those categories, on nature, on environment. Environment's got other problems. Let's not even get into that. Ecology. So we can think those, you know, in relation to the Anthropocene without trying to make any one of them a kind of ultra-true dominant category. Sorry that's a little long-winded, but it's kind of like the hardest thing to figure out, I think. Was for me.
I'm sorry, but we have time for one very short question and one very short answer.
Yeah, sorry the answers are long, but they're great questions, and the answers are kind of like, you know.
Hey, thanks for the talk. So you talked about the changing nature of the commodity form and the changing nature of labor. What do you think about the ruling class and how our idea of that and our definition of that might need to adapt?
Yeah, and I could give a long answer, but I'm not going to be allowed to. It's useful and not always use Marx's Das Kapital as the model because it's like an ideal type that only has two classes. Like Marx's political writings are much more useful because they're multi-class negotiations. Gramsci picks up on that. Actual social democrats, like, you know, are all about that. So much of German social democracy is all about the peasant question, yeah? We don't have peasants, so we don't read that stuff, but they're like trying to think a multi-class world and how can labor be allied with peasants when they're different? Like, it's not the multitude that's all, it's different. They have different interests, different worldviews, different agendas. So part of that is that ruling classes are also multiple. What if there was more than one ruling class? One of which is still based in extracting rent from land. It's just we don't strike it in its classic form of like the English aristocracy or the German Junker. We now encounter it in the form of these giant property trusts that own our cities and are driving up your rents. Yeah, so there's a way in which rent extraction is, in the classical sense, is still one of the central things. It's different. Rent is different from profit. Yeah, Ricardo's right about this. The reason owning property is such a good thing to be in is you can't magically make more of it. Yeah, it's fixed, it's limited. So the rent will go up as demand goes up and supply will not match it, different to profit. So there was already in classical political economy two ruling classes. What if there's a third? What if there's a new one? And what it owns and controls is not property, it's not the physical planet infrastructure of the means of industrial production, it's the information. What if you could control the whole value chain just by controlling the information? You'd be surprised at the range of companies that have placed a bet on that. Like you sort of think, oh yeah, that's Google's play, or that's Apple. It's also Walmart, yeah? Walmart is all about logistics. Everything else is just based on a logistical model. Their data centers are as big as their supermarkets, yeah? A lot of the brands we see on products, like they own the brand, they don't make the product. You outsource to some capitalist somewhere the job of making it, you just control it through the information. That includes the brands, the trade dress, the patents, the copyrights, perhaps more importantly, the logistics of how all of that information is threaded together. So what if there was like a, I called it the vectorless class, you control a vector, like it's how information moves and can act in the world. And you get access to the information in aggregate that you're denying even to your clients, yeah? And we all know Google runs basically by selling advertising, but they don't let those people know what they know. Yeah. So that would be the new ruling class, or a fraction thereof. And its relative weight in different political economies might vary. It's perhaps less dominant in the German case. Like this is like still a country that seems to be based on controlling certain kinds of scientific and engineering-based manufacturing and being world leaders in that and creating a relationship to a periphery where it is maintains its dominance, right? But the way to figure this out is look at countries' exports, yeah? In the United States, it's all financial services, military. You still have to build the stuff, but military is so much about the information that runs and controls it. And Hollywood, yeah, like that's all we export to the world, and some like random manufactured things. What if there was a new kind of ruling class? It's not necessarily dominant because it's in conflict with these other ones. One is rent extracting, one is still actually physically making things. But how do they form coalitions and alliances? Are there ways you can drive a wedge between them? How does the dominance of vectorless class change what kinds of consensus political economy you end up with? Is it because it's a new kind of ruling class that is really super interested in commodifying the information-based aspects of what the social state used to do better? Yeah? Like, we know this. Socialized medicine, it's not perfect, but it works better. Socialized education is not perfect, but it works better. We know this. That's what the 20th century built. But the game now is, well, we don't care if these new versions work less well, and they really do. Let's commodify all of that. That's what's going on in the United States. I think it's going to happen here eventually, yeah? So it's like, oh, sending these kids from, terribly broken up homes who have no food to public schools means the public schools are failing. It's like, no, they're not. They're doing this awesome job with people whose lives you've tried to destroy every other way. But now we have to destroy their schooling as well. Or let's commodify higher education. Already happened to the sciences in the United States when universities could own and control the intellectual property that the university generates. That's the new university, right? And places like Stanford become players where they never were before. So, in short, what if there is a new kind of ruling class? The old ones didn't go away. They're still there. What if there are new forms of subordinate class? What does it mean to sell information rather than physical labor? There's still peasants in the world, there's still industrial labor, but maybe the diagram of class forces is more complicated than it used to be, and I would need to think about new languages, new alliances. Everything's not always new, right? Sometimes the languages can be old that one will use to make this work, but one has to kind of think politics in the present. All right, now I'm getting the wind up, right? Yeah. Thank you for the awesome questions. I'm sorry that took a little bit of elaborating to get the whole piece of it.
There's still sun outside, I guess. Yeah. Thank you so much. It was so rich and inspiring, and we will be thinking about that for days.
Thank you, Julia.
Please join me thanking again Professor Mackenzie Work. Thank you.